Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 80 degrees. 88 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 60. Sunny tomorrow, warming up a bit with a high of 85, then cooling back down on Thursday. Partly sunny skies, very slight chance we could see some rain as well. Look for a high on Thursday of only 78 degrees. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 73 degrees. Supporters of a pro-solar initiative are pressing Arizona lawmakers not to back a competing proposal. KJZZ's Will Stone reports that was the point of a rally at the state capitol today.
The campaign to preserve key policies for rooftop solar is off to a fast start with millions in hand and more than 700 signature gatherers working to get the initiative on the November ballot. But the message to solar customers and employees outside the state Senate was not all sunshine and rainbows. It was a warning that an opposing ballot proposal could surface in the last stretch of this legislative session.
That would kill solar energy in our state, that would destroy thousands of jobs, and that would clearly harm thousands of Arizona families. And we have got to ask, why is that?
Chris Mays is leading the initiative and argues utilities like Arizona Public Service are to blame. For years, utilities have been fighting the solar industry over how much customers who are hooked up to the grid should pay. State Senator Debbie Lesko says she'll bring forward a referendum to undercut the solar initiative and instead keep those decisions in the hands of regulators. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Budget bills are expected to be introduced today at the state capitol, giving the public its first look at the proposed spending plan for the fiscal year starting on July 1st. Joining me to talk about what's in the budget and what isn't is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And Jim, what's your top line read of what's potentially most important or impactful in there?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the most important things politically and something that Governor Doug Ducey has talked about wanting to do is this budget, the way it is written, it is structurally balanced at the end of the upcoming fiscal year. And what that means, basically, is that the state's ongoing tax collections and its ongoing spending they're in the black. You know, they are taking in $2 million more year over year than they are going to be spending year over year. First time that that's happened in a long time, probably a generation, down at the state government. Typically, you know, the state spends more than it takes in, and it makes, or at least in terms of permanent revenues, and it makes that up in terms of one-time revenues or things like that. It spends a little bit more than the current year's budget, has some increases for some very modest increases for things like education, for K-12 and for higher ed and for the Department of Child Safety. But it also does include, roughly, I want to say like $26, $28 million in tax cuts, most of them for corporations.
Education advocates have been talking about, yes, we support Proposition 123, but we also need to see more of a commitment to fund schools in the budget. Do you get the sense that what is in this plan is going to satisfy those groups?
Not even a little bit. Basically, the only increase in funding for K-12 education is driven entirely by formula growth, and that is basically the money that the state has to pay to school districts for each and every student that is enrolled in school. You know, it comes down to $111 million of new K-12 funding, but basically all of that is money that is directly tied to the number of students they expect to be enrolled in school, not to any kind of actual baseline increase.
One of the other areas that some members, especially in the House, had been seen as maybe holding out for was a restoration or an unfreezing of the Kids Care health insurance program. That is not in the plan. Is there any chance that could be tacked onto it as it moves through the process and it would ultimately stay on?
In fact, yeah. That's actually what we've been hearing is that it's not in the bills as they're going to be introduced, but that there will be an amendment that gets made on the floor to add that provision into the budget. And it's mostly being done that way for political convenience and maybe a little bit of political theatrics. I think the primary reason is that the sponsor of the budget bills in the Senate is going to be Senate President Andy Biggs. He's an opponent of the Kids Care program, doesn't like it. He's also running for Congress in the East Valley. He has some obvious political reasons why he would not want to be supporting or sponsoring a bill that includes restoring this health care program for poor Arizona children. So the idea is essentially that he'll be able to introduce the bills. An amendment will get tacked on. He'll be able to vote no against the amendment, try to do what he can to fight it, and ultimately the budget will pass and that amendment will be on it, and kids care will be restored.
Based on what you've heard and what some of your colleagues have heard, is there enough support at this point to approve the budget as introduced and maybe with the kids care amendment?
I don't think so, not right now. The Senate looks like they've probably got the votes, or if they don't have them, they're very close and they could get the votes pretty quickly. The House, though, seems to be a different animal. The House is where we have, for the last month or two, been hearing a lot of rumblings about people not happy with the progress of the budget talks. And they had several specific things that they wanted to see in there. They wanted to see more money for universities, more money for K-12, changing some policies in K-12 in terms of how they calculate how much money they're going to need every year. And those things really aren't in this budget. There were a lot of really long faces and really, frankly, upset and angry House Republicans yesterday as they came out of their budget briefings. That does not bode well for this plan as it is to move through. Of course, with that being said, you know, things can move on a dime when it comes to the budget, and there's going to be no shortage of arm-twisting and whipping of votes that's happening behind the scenes. We don't know yet how many of those House Republicans are upset by the budget and are right now threatening to withhold their vote. That's a number that we'd heard could be as many as a dozen, but it's also a number that is probably only going to get smaller as the week goes on.
Jim Small is editor of Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Arizona Public Service plans to replace old natural gas generators in its Ocotillo Power Plant in Tempe. It'll take out two 1960s-era units and replace them with five new units that it says are more water and fuel efficient. Stephen Gottfried with APS says faster units will provide a reliable energy backup to fluctuating solar energy.
The old units took many hours to turn on, while these new units can be turned on and off within 9 or 10 minutes.
But the Sierra Club has filed an appeal of the power plant's air permit. The organization is concerned with the level of greenhouse gas emissions the plant would produce, specifically while the generators idle when not in use. Travis Ritchie is an attorney with the Sierra Club.
So Sierra Club was opposed not to the building of these units specifically, but to building them and permitting them to run in a very inefficient and thus very polluting manner.
The Sierra Club suggests the utility use batteries instead to store energy for times when renewable sources aren't enough, but Gottfried says the bids for the project that involved batteries were notably more expensive. Utility companies have to balance demand with clean energy, with cost. To talk about how that balance is maintained, I'm joined by Karin Wadsack, a project director at NAU, who works in the College of Engineering, Forestry, and Natural Sciences. And Karin, what do you make of this dispute between APS and the Sierra Club?
Taking a look at this in the bigger picture, APS is attempting to upgrade a power plant that arguably needs to be upgraded. And they are looking at their entire generation portfolio, not just today with whatever technology is available today, but with what they're expecting to see on the system. And so they're making decisions looking at the resources available, the cost of those technologies now, the likely cost in the future, and the other changes that they see taking place on their system. I think the Sierra Club is probably also looking at the system now and the system in the future, and I think the Sierra Club is playing a useful role in this discussion by pushing the envelope and asking APS to consider other options besides simply upgrading this plant.
How quickly does the technology that utilities can implement in power plants change or come online? In other words, if APS decides to go ahead with this upgrade now, does it run the risk of, like, 6 months from now having something even better that it could have used?
We always think that when we buy something, don't we? I think that with regard to the combustion technology for gas turbines, the particular model that APS is planning to install in this instance right now is the most efficient simple cycle combustion turbine that is available for the application they need. And it has a fast startup, which means that even if they do have it turned off, it has a 10-minute startup, so they'll be able to turn it on. And then their goal with this unit is to be able to ramp it up, so have the generation from this unit increase and decrease in response to other changes on the system, so so they can manage the system as a whole. Your question about how quickly the technology advances, the reason I was laughing is the other option that was suggested by both the Sierra Club and by RUCO, the Residential Utility Consumer Office, was that APS ought to look at energy storage. And energy storage is an area of technology that is advancing very quickly right now. However, energy storage is to some extent still in an experimental phase.
Well, if the technology that APS is looking to use at Ocotillo right now is about as good as it gets, based on what you said, how does that jibe with the Sierra Club's complaints that what APS is going to do and how it's going to use it would cause unnecessary emissions? I mean, if there's not really anything better, yeah, and this is the way that APS decides it wants to go, like, what are the other options?
Yeah. Well, so there's nothing better in terms of the particular type of natural gas-fired turbine. What the Sierra Club is doing is thinking outside the box and saying, instead of looking at the different options within the choices for natural gas turbine, are there other choices? And that's where that question about energy storage comes in.
Is this discussion that's going on with regards to this power plant, is it the same kind of conversation that's happening in other parts of the country, or is it unique to this specific case?
I think this conversation is happening in many parts of the country. Every time a utility makes a decision about a new piece of infrastructure, it's making a decision that's going to probably be in place for several decades. And so I think every time a power plant is being built, there are folks who are legitimately questioning, is this really the choice we should be making? This is not a new power plant, but every time this decision is made, APS needs to examine what are the best choices for meeting its portfolio of needs, and the general public, environmental advocacy groups, consumer advocates also need to make their concerns known so that a robust conversation can take place around this discussion of what choices we're making that we're going to be stuck with for the next 30 years.
Karin Wadsack is a project director at NAU in the College of Engineering, Forestry, and Natural Sciences. How prepared is Arizona to deal with a health emergency? According to a new index, not that well prepared. The state's overall score is among the lowest in the country on the newly released 2015 National Health Security Preparedness Index. Glenn Mays manages the National Program Office for that index. He's also a professor of health policy at the University of Kentucky. And Glenn, what are you looking for when you're putting this report together?
Well, we know that really a lot of different practices come into play if we want to protect people's health in the face of disasters or other large-scale emergencies. Everything from detecting potential health problems early, outbreaks or problems with food or water or air, to be able to rapidly respond to disasters when they occur, get people health care and other needed resources as quickly as possible, to putting in place the kinds of strategies that can help communities recover rapidly and get back to normal as quickly as possible.
Now, it looks like overall Arizona's overall score was a little bit less than the national average. Tell me what that means. How should we be interpreting that?
So Arizona, and we score the index, all these measures are scored into an index that ranges from 0 to 10, with 10 being the highest level of preparedness. Arizona scored 5.8 on that 10-point scale, which is a level that does fall a bit below the preparedness level for the nation as a whole. And I would say that Arizona is not alone in that. In fact, there's a group of states that are kind of along the Mountain West, running from north to south, that are also in that same ballpark in terms of preparedness levels. On a bright spot, if we look at Arizona's trends over time, we do see that Arizona has been making substantial improvements in its preparedness scores over time, about a 6.6 improvement overall improvement level for Arizona since 2013.
That 5.8 score, though, is one of the lowest in the country. I mean, is that something that we should be concerned about, or is that just a matter of all the other states are doing fantastically?
Well, it is something that is worthy of some concern and attention. Now, we know these index results show very clearly that health protections are not distributed evenly across the U.S. And again, Arizona falls within a cluster of states there in the Mountain West that fall significantly below the preparedness levels that we see for the nation as a whole. So I think partly what that tells us is that we need to look for opportunities for improving health protections there in Arizona. And the good news is we see that Arizona is making quite some progress on that front. The rate of improvement in Arizona is almost twice the rate of improvement that we see for the nation as a whole. So Arizona is lagging a bit behind, but it's rapidly catching up.
So if you're looking at Arizona's overall score and then breaking it down into the different areas in which you measure, if you had to give state officials a couple of pieces of advice of things that the state could really do or should be doing to try to not only bring up its scores, but make sure that it is more and better prepared, what are some of the things that you would suggest that Arizona should really be focusing on?
Well, looking at Arizona's index results, two areas pop out to me as being worth attention. One, in the area of community planning and engagement. We see that Arizona does score relatively low on that dimension, engaging the full array of stakeholders across the state in collaborative planning and coordinated policymaking for planning, making sure that you've got healthcare providers, schools, child care centers, government agencies, and employers in the private sector engaged in collaborative planning for disasters and making sure you've got strong communication mechanisms there. So that's a critically important domain, and I think one where, again, there's a lot of room for improvement for Arizona that will have real benefits over time. The other area I'd suggest for focusing in on is in the healthcare delivery domain, making sure that your hospitals, physicians, nursing homes, other elements of healthcare delivery are well prepared to continue delivering high-quality services in the event of a disaster or an emergency. That's just a critical area, and Arizona seems to have lost some strength in that area, in that domain of preparedness over time, so that's worth a closer look.
Glenn Mace is a professor of health policy at the University of Kentucky. He also manages the National Program Office for the National Health Security Preparedness Index. We'll post a link to the index at theshow.kjzz.org.
More than 1.2 million people in the U.S. are living with HIV, and one in eight of them don't know they have the infection, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. Here in the Valley, one hospital is trying to find those people, diagnose them, and get them into treatment. The show's Lauren Gilger is here, and Lauren, you went to Maricopa Integrated Health Systems to talk to the people who are spearheading this program. What did you find out?
So the medical center has a program called Test AZ, and it means in a nutshell that they test everyone who comes into their emergency department for HIV unless they opt out. It's funded by a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they're the only hospital in the state that's doing it.
So the traditional way hospitals test for HIV is an opt-in kind of program?
That's more common, yes. Providers will do what's called targeted testing. They'll assess a patient's risk factors like age and race and sexual history, and then they'll test those who they think are most likely to have contracted the disease. But at Maricopa Medical Center, they're testing everyone, and they're finding people who are HIV positive who might never have known otherwise. I spent some time in their emergency department to see how it works.
This is a pretty busy morning, but mornings are quieter.
There's no difficulty breathing, shortness of breath.
The dispatch phone buzzes with calls from incoming ambulances. Clerks answer calls, nurses monitor patients.
This is our critical care area.
Normally, emergency departments are for just this, emergencies.
When traumas come in, time is of the essence. So.
But here at the county's public hospital, the emergency department is also testing every patient who gets their blood drawn for HIV.
Historically, public health and emergency medicine are not seen as something that go together.
Dr. Kara Garrett is an attending physician here and the physician lead of the Test AZ program.
So the idea is you're drawing blood anyway, you're testing for all these things anyway, why not?
Yep. We're drawing blood anyway, and part of our goal was to make it part of the system.
She says some emergency departments have special teams that seek out patients to test for HIV.
So it's basically an additional person, and it's a system outside of the normal emergency department flow. And we knew that in order to for the program to be sustainable, we needed to make it a seamless part of the flow. So as a result, we ask in triage, we're going to test you unless you opt out.
Test AZ began in 2011, and they've tested about 40,000 patients since. Social worker Amy Edmonds is the coordinator of Test AZ.
We test in accordance with the CDC guidelines. We test everybody for HIV unless you tell us otherwise.
The test doesn't cost you anything extra. It's covered by most insurance companies. And if you don't have insurance, that's what the CDC's grant covers. And testing everyone, Edmund says, helps remove the stigma surrounding HIV and AIDS.
We're not judging them, or we're not saying, you look like you might be at risk for HIV, or asking. We made it easy so we don't have to ask all those risk questions and triage.
Out of that 40,000 tested, the Test AZ program has diagnosed more than 150 new patients with HIV, according to Edmonds, which might not seem like a lot.
But that's 150 people in the last 5 years who did not know they were positive and now are linked to care and are aware of it and are able to, you know, take safe sex practices and notify their partners.
And they're diagnosing a surprising number of patients early when they're most infectious.
So when you're in the acute infection, you are most likely to be able to transmit it to another person. And if you get into care earlier during the acute infection, not only can you stop the transmission, but also studies have shown that long term you'll do better.
Almost 20% of their new diagnoses have been acute infections.
It affects everyone. There's no socioeconomic, ethnicity, gender barriers. It used to be a disease of men that had sex with men, and that is not true at all any longer, and it hasn't been for quite a while.
According to the Department of Health and Human Services, about 1 in 4 new HIV infections is among people as young as 13, and most of them don't know they're infected.
We've had a lot of young people who have been diagnosed recently, and it is quite a shock to them.
As a social worker, Edmonds is there when every patient is given their positive diagnosis in the emergency department to make sure they know they can live with the disease and to make sure they're connected to care. She says there are lots of barriers to care when it comes to treating HIV, especially for people who don't get regular preventative health care.
Mental health, substance use, homelessness, kind of a lot of things that we see in the emergency department here are the biggest things that prevent people from care.
And once they're diagnosed, keeping patients actively involved in care is another challenge. According to the CDC, 87% of HIV-positive people in the country have been diagnosed, but less than 40% are engaged in and have retained HIV care. And to Edmonds, each time they find a new person who tests positive, it's an opportunity.
So don't look at the bad side, like it's sad that we found someone. Yes, it is sad, but go to the next step of now they know, now they're in care, and now they can do something about it. And I know that we're in a day and age right now where really, if you know your status, nobody should die of HIV. Take your meds. You should live a healthy life.
Amy Edmonds also works as a social worker at the Infectious Disease Clinic at Phoenix Children's Hospital. They started treating HIV in infants and children in the 1990s. Back then, a lot of infants were contracting the infection from their mothers at birth. But that all changed when providers began testing pregnant women for HIV, and researchers found a treatment plan that has nearly solved the problem.
If we do all of the right things during pregnancy, we identify that the mom is infected, and we can get her on treatment and then do all the right things around labor delivery and then help the baby afterwards, we can prevent 98% of infections or more.
That's Dr. Janice Pyatt. She's the medical director of the Bill Holt Pediatric Infectious Disease Clinic at Phoenix Children's Hospital. And she says they used to see up to 1,000 babies born HIV positive a year, and now they're seeing just 50 or 100 a year.
Wow, that's some drop. So who are they still treating at Phoenix Children's Hospital?
That's the question. Dr. Pyatt says because of this drop, a lot of pediatric HIV clinics around the country are seeing their number of patients decline.
Those clinics, their patients are aging out, and they're not getting a lot of new ones. But that isn't happening here yet.
And why isn't that happening yet?
So here it's for a few reasons. Pyatt says we have a large refugee population here in the Valley, and they're still seeing higher rates of infection.
We see children from Africa, from Asia, from Ukraine. So we've had, I would say, 35 to 45% of our patients now are refugee children.
She also says they're seeing a number of teenagers who are contracting the disease.
So does she think this is a generational issue? I mean, younger people today just don't know the risk of HIV and AIDS like people who saw the epidemic hit in the 80s?
In part, yes. When it comes to age groups, young people have the highest risk of contracting HIV. It's 13 to 24-year-olds. I talked to Jeremy Bright with the Southwest Center for HIV and AIDS about this generational divide. They do a lot of outreach about HIV to young people in the Valley, and he says back in the day when you got diagnosed with HIV, the question used to be, how long do I live? And now he said the question's more like, how do I date?
So there's definitely a generational gap where there's an older generation saying, what are you doing? And why are you being so reckless? Where this younger generation saying, hey, I didn't really grow up with that. I didn't understand that. And that's not where it is today. So someone who saw 20 of their friends die in the 80s around them, has a very, very deep connection to that. And so if they see the youth not understanding kind of where they're coming from and their approach to HIV, then that's where you start to clash.
So Dr. Pyatt with Phoenix Children's Hospital says the first thing that has to be done to combat the spread among young people is testing. She says she wants to start doing routine opt-out testing for HIV, much like TestAZ does at Maricopa Medical Center.
That seems like quite an undertaking. Is she worried about getting people to agree to have their kids tested for HIV?
Yes, and she knows it'll be a real challenge.
There's a lot of stigma with HIV, and I think to screen everybody, you have to do some work to make that acceptable to people. And to tell, you know, a family that's coming in here for a pediatric visit or an adolescent visit that we're screening everybody, we have to do some education. We had to do that for pregnant women. We did a lot of work. It took about 12 years here to really get that going. And so we have to overcome that.
Dr. Pyatt says she'll keep working to implement routine testing for HIV for young people in her clinic.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
You're very welcome.
ASU is looking to open a retirement community on the corner of Mill and University in Tempe. It'd include 230 independent living units as well as assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing units. Randy Levin is Senior Vice President of the ASU Foundation. And Randy, what's the idea behind this?
So there's a couple things. First of all, we're not aging the way we have in the past. Those of us that are baby boomers, we may be in our 60s and 70s, but we certainly feel like we're 30 or 40. And we just don't have this attitude that we want to, you know, spend the next 30 years of our lives golfing and playing cards. Not that that's bad, but we want something that's a little bit more intellectually stimulating, a little bit more challenging. We want to feel useful. And so there's 100 universities that have already done this very successfully, where they have brought some of their retired professors, their alumni, people who have an affinity for that particular university, to come back to school, so to speak. We actually are planning on giving our residents a ASU Sun Card. They can, with the idea that they can use the library, they can take classes, they can be just like any other student on campus. But we're also hoping that they're going to want to perhaps be adjunct professors, teaching assistants, mentor our students.
Are you thinking that the majority or only the people who'd live there would be affiliated with ASU? I mean, would this be open to anybody who is interested in having that kind of lifestyle?
It's open to anybody. Obviously, we're going to have some little priority status for those that have an affinity to ASU, whether they be retired faculty and staff, whether they be alumni. These type of facilities that are on campuses tend to fill up pretty quickly. So we'll see how it goes.
I want to put this delicately because I know that there are some times where there are, let's say, differences in opinion over lifestyle between college students and retirees as far as noise and as far as the hours that are kept and just sort of general lifestyle. So I'm curious how you envision sort of working through some of those, let's call them differences.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I'm just not convinced that the differences are maybe as broad or as different as you think. I mean, I have a son who's 26 years old, and we go to the same music concerts. We enjoy the same music. We have the same attitudes on what's going on around the world. We have the same interests. I'm not sure that college students have the reputation that they, you know, that some people give them. Here at ASU, we've worked really hard to have our students really understand that they're here for an education. They're here to have a good time as well, but you know, everything has its boundaries, and so we don't see any problems with, you know, having a younger set of people mixing with an older set of people. In fact, we embrace that. This is all about intergenerational relationships, so we're planning a full integration.
How do you see this project sort of fitting in with the overall scheme of what ASU has been trying to do over the past several years?
It fits in very well. President Crowe's done a really good job of basically having a university be something that is for the whole community. We're not only servicing, you know, students that are 18 to 24 years of age, but we're going after all ages. And so this benefits the entire community in multiple ways, and this just adds another component to it.
Randy Levin is Senior Vice President at the ASU Foundation. Randy, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
It's the show for Tuesday, April 26th. Thanks for listening. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. The Democratic and Republican National Conventions this July promise to be some of the most interesting in recent memory. There are rumblings the GOP convention could be a contested one. The last time that happened was 1976. We have a conversation now with a political activist and analyst. Tanya Milich was at the GOP convention in 1952 and was there every 4 years, with one exception, until 1996. She left the GOP to co-found the National Women's Political Caucus and write a political classic, The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines.
Milich was a delegate, Republican activist, and a passionate feminist. 1976 was the last contested GOP convention, and she was there when rising star Ronald Reagan squared off against President Gerald Ford in Kansas City.
Mrs. Ford is arriving at the instant that the Reagans have arrived on the other side. The Reagans are inside the auditorium. The band has started to play, and there you see Mrs. Ford and her sons on the way inside.
In the end, the only thing Gerald Ford had going for him was the fact that he was the incumbent president. Ford held off the Reagan challenge.
Delegates and alternates to this Republican convention, I am honored by your nomination, and I accept it.
Tanya Milich says there is still a lot to be learned from the nomination battles, and she can't wait to see what happens this summer in Cleveland and Philadelphia to see if it rivals the drama of Kansas City.
The dynamic at the 76 convention was really about whether or not you were going to throw out a sitting president. That's what it was about. And it doesn't compare with what our situation now, because Gerald Ford, as the president, had an enormous power and influence among a lot of Republicans, including those Goldwater people who were Southern and Western people.
But he wasn't elected. He only took over because Nixon resigned. So he didn't have an electoral mandate behind him. And
that's
correct. The argument.
That's the argument. But when you are the president of the United States, you have prestige and respect. And before the convention, delegates were invited to meet Betty Ford, to meet the family. The monkey wrench in all of this is, of course, when Ford pardoned Nixon. If Ford hadn't pardoned Nixon, given the closeness of that election, 76, Ford might have won.
Hmm. Who's running the show if it's a contested convention?
The advantages are twofold. One is that the head of the RNC, Rice Priebus, from Wisconsin, same place as Paul Ryan. The Wisconsin Republicans are very powerful. The people who are in charge of who gets the tickets, what kind of room you get to hold your rallies in, hotel rooms, are you way out 15 miles away from the convention center? All of those logistics things are controlled through the Republican National Committee.
So how does someone get delegates that they don't have committed? Do you just schmooze them? Do you?
You schmooze them. You do the kind of things that Americans have been doing from the beginning of our country. If you do as Cruz has done, and I think what Walker tried to do at the beginning, and Jeb Bush's people, you call up the people you know and you talk to them. You have a beer. You invite them to a party. You go to their children's little league game. Again, what's important here is this is not a general election fight. This is a fight within a political party.
So there's no rules, really. Compare this coming convention to what you've already seen. This seems more chaotic than anything I can remember.
When I decided to write a piece about this, I went back and I read through the contested conventions of the Republican Party. And there are a couple that stand out. The first one is 1912. Anybody who really wants to have an exciting read for an evening, go back and read about William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt.
Are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not.
May we not hope that the great majority of voters will be able to distinguish between the substance of performance and the question of prompt?
I can't tell you if it's as chaotic as what we have, but The fight was over. Guess what? Delegates and how these delegates were going to be selected in, as usual, the southern states. And it was over representation of blacks. And the numbers were such that Teddy finally walked out. Now, you could have a situation where Trump walks out. The difference between the 1912 and this present situation is that William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt were together. They were both Republicans. They had been active for many, many years in the party. So then we move up to 1952. Again, you have Taft and Eisenhower, not outsiders. The fight is enormous. Maybe not as chaotic, but that's probably because we have the net and all this communication. And then you had uncommitteds, and this is the other thing we need to watch, our
right.
governors. Harold Stassen in Minnesota was a favorite son, kind of like we could say Kasich was
sure.
in Ohio.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman,
gentlemen,
Minnesota wishes to change its vote to Eisenhower.
Earl Warren in California, he was holding his delegates. Governor McClellan in Maryland. So they went to this convention in 52. Taft was ahead. Taft controlled what was thought to be the mechanism, like I said, Rice Priebus does, except they were 70 short, Taft was. And I think of all the contested conventions that you can look at in the Republican Party, it is the 52 convention that will give us the most guidance, because this is the convention where the fight was again over rules.
Tanya Milich has attended every Republican convention from 1952 through 1996, with the exception of 1984. She was at the last contested Republican convention back in 1976. Tanya, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed speaking with you, John.
Great.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Democracy Now! Is a daily news show that began 20 years ago on the Pacifica Network. It now runs on more than 1,400 public television and radio stations around the country and around the world. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me. And Jimmy, you had a chance to speak with the host, Amy Goodman?
That's right, Mark. Democracy Now! Actually started broadcasting on just 9 community radio stations in 1996. And they were the only public radio program devoting daily coverage to the 1996 presidential election. So 2 decades later, they're taking their show on the road and broadcasting from all the primary states in this presidential election. And I asked Amy how the issues and the coverage have changed over the years.
You know, it has been a fascinating 20-year journey. And I think why the show has been such a success is because we go to the grassroots. We go from state to state, for example, in this primary year, speaking to people about how they are engaged, whether or not they're voting. That's a big story in this country. In most of the industrialized world, the vast majority of people vote. In the United States, we barely get over half. Why is that? We've got obstacles to voting that are increasingly placed in the path of people, particularly poor people and people of color. Also, I think over the years, the concern that people don't feel inspired to vote. It's not that they're apathetic, but they're feeling what's the difference between the candidates. I think that's changed a bit this year in 2016. People are politically engaged, and it's our job as journalists to cover the issues.
So what issues do you think maybe are given short shrift and that you take the opportunity to emphasize on your show?
Well, you know, the immigrants' rights movement is so critical to hear now. Also, the Black Lives Matter movement, the women's rights movement, the lesbian and gay movement, the environmental movement, the peace movement, Occupy, the movement that challenges inequality in this country. All of these movements have been so important, seminal, in this 20 years in shaping this country. Their wins, their losses. What counts is a media that is fair in covering them, giving voice to them.
Because Democracy Now! Chooses to focus on those issues, do you think it pigeonholes you as coming from a certain direction, be it called liberal or progressive?
I mean, we cover movements. I think we are following the basic tenets of good journalism, and that is going to where the silence is. often actually it's not that quiet. It's just that the corporate media does not point their microphones and their cameras in that direction. I mean, these are the people in this country, not the generals and the presidents and the congressmen and the congresswomen, but these are the people at the grassroots that are determining the future, that are making history.
Democracy Now! Is supported by listeners and foundations, much like NPR, and you bill yourself as an independent media outlet. So do you believe that the way you're funded gives you a certain type of freedom when it comes to the topics that you choose and the way you cover them?
Well, you know, it's key. When listeners and viewers and readers support the media that they are dependent on, that they are consuming, it's a very different kind of media. When we cover war, we're not brought to you by the weapons manufacturers. When we cover climate change, we're not brought to you by the oil, the gas, the coal, the nuclear companies. When we cover health care, we're not brought to you by the insurance industry or by big pharma, the drug companies. We're brought to the listeners, viewers, and readers by the people themselves. That's an independent media that serves a democratic society. I think independent media is the oxygen of a democracy. You know, I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day.
And Mark, Amy Goodman will be in Arizona for the next few days to discuss those issues. She's in Flagstaff tomorrow night, Phoenix on Thursday at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe, and then Tucson Thursday night. We'll link to the events page at our website, kjzz.org.
That was KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins speaking with Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Mark.
A delegation from the University of Arizona is in Germany this week, taking part in what's described as the world's largest advanced technology conference and expo. It's called Hannover Messe, and this year the U.S. is the featured country. Bruce Wright is Associate Vice President for Tech Parks Arizona at U of A. And Bruce, what do you hope to achieve from this trip?
Well, our goal is to try to attract technology companies from around the world into one of our two tech parks in Tucson. So that they would establish a place of business, affiliate with the university, potentially hire some of our students as in our graduates, and hopefully start to create some economic value here in the state.
Do you have any particular businesses or particular countries in mind that you're targeting?
We do. So first, we're trying to target small, mid-sized, fast-growth technology companies. In our case, because of the research strengths of the U of A, we're targeted in six technology sectors. And we're actually reaching out to them and saying, would you have interest in coming into the U.S. and the North American market? And we focus a lot on companies that are either looking for market access or need assistance in either developing or introducing their product to the marketplace.
What do you try to sell them on as a way to come to Southern Arizona? So I'm guessing there are some people in parts of Europe or other parts of the world who maybe haven't heard of Tucson, Arizona.
Well, that's in case the fact. I don't know that Tucson is perceived worldwide as being a tech center, although I think we are. Yeah, we're trying to do several things. First of all, is the connectivity to the university and the research enterprise there. Secondly, access to our students, who are some of the best and brightest who can provide the employees for their companies. And then access to this very large market. They can go to California, they can go to Texas, two of the largest economies in the world, the Sun Corridor from Flagstaff all the way down to Nogales, and then even into northern and western Mexico.
For folks who aren't familiar with this particular conference, this Hannover Messe, how would you describe it?
Well, there'll be about 200,000 people from around the world that come and participate in a series of workshops and seminars and networking events, business-to-business meetings. And so we've been actually recruited by the U.S. Department of Commerce to establish a presence there, and we're among five universities that are being showcased that will be in what's called the Technology Pavilion. There are several other pavilions, including a business pavilion, and there's a group from the Greater Phoenix Economic Council that will be there as well.
How high would you say your expectations are for what you come away from this experience with?
Well, first, we want to put Arizona, Phoenix, and Tucson on the technology map. So we have high expectations about being able to do that. We right now have appointments set up with about 40 companies, individual appointments, and we're hoping that if we could successfully recruit four or five of those companies as a result of this fair, that would be a huge success for us.
Am I right that you're looking at having at not necessarily businesses like relocating their whole operations? Are you looking for like satellite offices in Tucson?
Well, two things. I think the first is we're looking for companies that need to enter the North American market. Maybe they primarily have been selling their product in Europe or other places, and they need to get into North America. So we're providing them a soft landing location where they come in, and we help them with all aspects of their business entry and development. And the second, and probably the most important, is that we help them with their product development. So the ability to test, evaluate, demonstrate their product to the marketplace. And we have significant testing capabilities and facilities at our tech parks.
You referenced the markets of Texas and California, and I'm wondering if they are also competition for this sort of thing. I mean, I imagine the UT or the UC systems would be more than happy to have companies come and work with them as well. I mean, do you find yourself competing with either those states or even other states in the Southwest or in the rest of the country?
Absolutely. And, you know, California is perceived as the tech center of the U.S. with the Silicon Valley, with the bio industry in San Diego and even in Los Angeles. And, of course, Austin in Texas and the University of Texas is a well-known tech center. So, yes, we're competing with those areas. But one of the things we offer in Arizona is access to those markets, but at a much more price-competitive position. I mean, it's cheaper to do business here in Arizona than it is to go into Los Angeles or the Bay Area.
Bruce Wright is the Associate Vice President for Tech Parks Arizona. Bruce, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Native American fashion is in the middle of a renaissance. Not only is the number of Native fashion designers growing, but so is their influence. Now, a major art exhibit featuring only Native designers is traveling around the country. It's called Native Fashion Now, and it showcases more than 70 designers, including one who lives here in the Valley. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to a Navajo man out to change perceptions with T-shirts.
Jared Yazzie is probably best known for these four words: Native Americans discovered Columbus.
It's just something we used to joke about back in the day in college, and I threw it on a tee and everyone seemed to like it.
Meaning his friends, but also fans and fashion bloggers. The black shirt emblazoned with white and yellow block letters started popping up at concerts and protests, even CNN's website. That was a few years ago, and it was the first big splash for Yazzie, who grew up in Holbrook but is now based in Tempe. His line, OXDX Clothing, is best known for its graphic, screen-printed shirts highlighting issues that affect Native Americans, like one that says water is life, or the one that Yazzie calls his Uncle Scam tee.
Which was the real political one, I guess, which is a Uncle Sam image, except he's wearing a ski mask.
Yazzie once got punched in the face for wearing that one.
Just because there were old military guys that didn't understand what I was talking about.
What Yazzie is trying to talk about with this work is the reality of Native American life today, the beauty and the pain.
You need to cause a little distress, you need to cause a little controversy, but in the end, it's all for a positive impact.
Part of that, says Jacqueline Russell, is simply reminding non-Natives that Native Americans still exist.
There's this very like poetic, ninja-like infiltration that happens when you have a bunch of people who are wearing their Native Americans discovered Columbus shirts to work.
Russell, a fellow Navajo, is a fashion blogger and longtime fan of Yazzie's. She's sitting outside her workplace, the Heard Museum in Phoenix, which is filled with art from other contemporary Native Americans. Russell says Yazzie is one of many Native designers who sometimes get pushback from elders for not being, quote, traditional enough. But Russell says they're actually following a long-held Native tradition of using whatever new materials are available to create work.
We are living, breathing people, and we practice our culture every day. So why not be able to bead on a pair of Christian Louboutin heels? You know, that's fashion. It's now.
And it's gaining momentum.
Welcome, OXDX.
That's the sound of Jared Yazzie's brand hitting the outdoor catwalk at a fashion show for Native designers at Arizona State University. It's one of many shows Yazzie will do this year, from Denver to Tuba City. One of his models, Tenate Ortiz, is only 15. But has already been following and wearing Yazzie for 2 years.
He's setting the bar.
For all Native artists, Ortiz, a White Mountain Apache, wants to be a rapper.
He's paving like a new direction where Native American careers can go.
Yazzie is humble about his success. He's crashing at his brother's house these days and jokes that his car is held together by duct tape. But he's making a living and an impact by embracing his Navajo heritage.
It's a beautiful culture, and I just want it to be reflected and to make beautiful things and to make people feel a beautiful way. That's, you know, why I'm in this business.
A business in which Yazzie hopes many more Native Americans will discover success. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.